be explained to them, which could be translation. Yeah. Very clear. We had Jim talk about the case where in Acts 22, it's actually Aramaic or Hebrew, Paul addresses the crowd in that language. Earlier in the chapter, it's just mentioned that he's been speaking Greek to the Roman commander. New Testament is thoroughly written in a multilingual context in a society quite different from our own. We all come basically Westerners, we come from monolingual societies, and we sometimes have the temptation to look at multilingual societies as if they're just aberrations of our sort of monolingual society. So you make some assumptions about that sort of thing. Now, was the Bible written, the whole biblical period, multilingual? That time, yeah. I mean, you've got, well, if they'd just come out of Egypt, they probably spoke Egyptian, but they probably we've forgotten it by then. But up until the exile, there's evidence, there's actually one passage where Jerusalem is being besieged, and it's quite, in the discussion, language comes out in the discussion, and it's quite clear that normal populace of Jerusalem did not speak Aramaic at that time. It's one of the things that's mentioned in the passage. You get these little tidbits about what language people are speaking. So up until the exile, basically a monolingual society. From the exile into the New Testament, we're dealing with multilingual societies, which in some ways look more like an African situation than they do like a European situation. I'm not just talking about Africa, but pretty much all my examples will be from Africa, because that's the system I've looked at and discussed the most. So, societal multilingualism, and here we're coming on to the statement, the question that John made. It's different from lots of people just being able to speak a whole variety of languages. Now, I'm an Englishman, as I've already made clear, and I can actually probably have a pretty good conversation with you in French or in Arabic. I could also have a go in one or two other languages. So but that's nothing to do with me being English. There isn't an occasion, here I am in Norwich, where I think, you know, I think I should speak French here. It would work better. That's when I go to France. But in my own society, I use English for everything. So it's not the fact that you go to Africa and boy, these people can speak so many languages. It's the fact that they're kind of expected to speak, in many African contexts, three, at least to some level. And that it's appropriate to use those in different contexts. So this societal multilingualism is where a society uses different languages for different functions, not just to talk to different people. I speak Somali to him because he's Somali, Amharic to him because he's Amharic. And also you get broadly shared values, not 100% shared, but broadly shared values about which language is most appropriate in which context. So people will just know what to do. Doesn't mean that everybody fully participates in the system. So it doesn't mean that everybody in Kenya or Uganda speaks great English. They know there are times to speak English, but maybe then they wouldn't be able to have a conversation about certain things and so on. And the society is not the same as the nation. So the system is often locally or regionally defined. I mean, somewhere like Uganda, you've got different systems going on in different parts of the country, which language is appropriate. So the society is not necessarily the same as the nation. So the danger of approaching multilingualism as a Westerner is that we approach it with some monolingual assumptions. And, you know, we take our Reformation history, and our Reformation history is wonderful. You know, people used to have to read, write, and buy the Bible. Well, they didn't write the Bible. Read the Bible or hear it in Latin, whereas they would speak English or Dutch or French in everyday life. It's not quite the same situation that we have in Africa. You know, maybe they're using the Bible in English. They're probably doing one or two other things in English that people then weren't doing in Latin. But sometimes, here's a brief critique of biblical studies, and occasionally the arguments over when Hebrew died out in Palestine are due to the fact people say, well, look at the inscriptions. They've now switched to Aramaic by the 3rd century before Christ. Well, if you go around Kenya today and looking at the signposting, you'd say that Swahili was barely spoken because it's all in English. But that's what you get. You get signage in English, especially official signage. But everyone around you is speaking Swahili or Kikuyu, etc., etc. And we get to what I've invented a word. I think I've invented it anyway. Monolinguist. Someone who has a monolingual ideology. There are two errors that it's easy to make coming from a society like ours when we go to a multilingual society. One is, everybody's losing their language in this place. That does sometimes happen. People do sometimes all lose their language. But often an outside observer, especially from the West, will overestimate that. Or everyone's speaking English. And then when you dig a bit deep, the everyone may be the educated middle class who have degrees. Now, in Kenya, it's more than that. But often the perception runs too quickly one way, or the other way, is that everything authentic, to be authentic, everything has to be in the vernacular. That the vernacular should fulfill all the functions that English does. And I think they're both coming from a perspective where we expect people to speak the same language all the time. Because that's normal. Well, it's normal for us, but for about half the world, it's not normal. Use different languages for different things. So what I'm going to do now is look at, try and describe what I'm calling a common African system. And also a very similar system would exist probably in much of the Pacific as well, Papua New Guinea, places like that. In one or two bits of India, but not everywhere in Africa works quite this way, but this is the most common African system, which is a three-language system. And I'll describe each type of language. First, you've got the what we call the vernacular, which people will say lots of different things. Mother tongue. Now, mother tongue actually is a little bit of a dangerous word in Africa, because to me, mother tongue means, and actually the technical definition, is it's your first language, your dominant language. Whereas, go to Kenya somewhere, and you'll find mother tongue is the language of your tribe, even if you don't speak it. So often we end up speaking at cross purposes when we use the word mother tongue. But anyway, vernacular, language most closely associated with a traditional ethnic identity. So, for a Kikuyu, it'll be Kikuyu, for a Luo, it'll be Luo, and so on. And generally in the village, and more variably in formal urban contexts, slums and stuff like that, it'll be the first language learnt by children. Use in society tends to be primarily oral, mainly used for speaking. I've said people normally have similar evaluations of what should go on in which language in different contexts. Church is the one exception. Different churches do different things, often because of tradition and what's been done before. You'll sometimes find some use of the language in primary school, but often more in policy than natural practice. Okay, so that's the what I'm calling the vernacular. That's not my word for it. And then we have the one that's maybe slightly harder to name. The more common sociolinguistic description would be language of wider communication, LWC. I'll probably say LWC. That's what it is. People also call it a trade language, a market language, a vehicular language. That's probably used more in French, langue véhiculaire, and lingua franca. Typically, this will be also another African language, but it's used for inter-ethnic communication. So markets, people talk about a market language in the countryside, if there's a market and so on. Depends where in the countryside. If it's in the center of of just one people, they'll probably just use their own language. Towns in Africa are often quite recently formed in the last 100 years or so. Nairobi was only founded in 1895, and then even at that point it was mainly made up of Indians and Brits. So this functions as the inter-ethnic language, often has become in cities the or a first language learnt by children. You're often getting children growing up with more than one language at home. So often that will be maybe a combination of vernacular and the LWC. Still, again, mainly orally used, and but also a bit more writing. But the one thing where this model doesn't really predict very well what happens is the different LWCs have very different perceptions of acceptability in writing. So Swahili, you'll see, find lots of writings in Swahili, say in Tanzania. And LWC in South Sudan, in much of South Sudan, is Juba Arabic, and people don't want to see that written at all because the belief is it's a broken form of Arabic. So you have some LWCs very widely accepted for use of Bible and so on, and others which are just oral. Sometimes schooling. Yeah, John. There are two types, and that's one of the... Yeah. You've got two types. You've got ones like Swahili, which belong to a very small group or to not no group at all, like Juba Arabic. It's not an ethnic, it doesn't belong to one ethnic group. They tend to spread quite easily because people don't feel threatened by them. However, Uganda is a bit more complicated on this because in the middle of Uganda, you've got Luganda, which works well for the Luganda and one or two other groups around them. And I guess in Kampala, it's what people speak to strangers. But in other parts of Uganda, people use Swahili as the LWC because Luganda belongs to the Baganda. So it probably is almost a break on its spreading because of its perceived identity marking. Whereas you can speak Swahili in Kenya. It doesn't mean you're a Swahili. There are only a few thousand of them. They live on the coast, and they don't even look black. Well, some of them do, but some of them don't. And they're all Muslim. But people... So there's that... There are the two types. You've got Sango. You've got Swahili in Eastern Congo. You know, no one speaks... There's no Swahilis there. So you've got the two types, and they tend to behave differently. So Uganda is a place where it's a bit on a national level. You couldn't really say you have an African LWC. You've got Swahili trying to take that role. You've got Luganda trying to take that role. You've got English kind of taking that role in some places. It's even though it's not an African language. In a way that in Kenya, everyone knows Swahili. Everyone. Yeah. Okay, and then you have what I'm calling an official language. You could also call colonial or ex-colonial language. Oh, thank you. It's on my screen. Typically a European language used for education, especially the higher up in the system you go. In law, even in somewhere like Tanzania, which gives Swahili very high status, the laws are in English, used in administration, international communication, and most writing. Now, the problem with the word official language is sometimes in the constitution. So, for example, in the new constitution of Kenya, it has two official languages, Swahili and English. But it's legally official, but not in practice. You're still not finding the constitution is not written in Swahili. It's in English. You do find in some places, this is variable, a few people learning this as their first and dominant language by generally members of the elite who are internationally connected. But it's mainly learnt at school. Primarily formal use, often used in church. Again, that's very variable, and as has been pointed out by Jim, in theological training. If it's real theological training, it's often in the official language. I'm not saying that as that's quoting someone else's opinion, okay? It's not what I actually think. So just to check that we're all together. Some of the context, you know, I thought maybe you'd try and give me one or two names of languages that you think fit into those categories, or maybe the one or two that don't quite fit, and we'll see that we're on the same page together. So we've already had a little chat about Uganda, because Luganda does take a bit of an LWC role for central Uganda. Chichewa in Malawi, yeah, that would be both a vernacular and an LWC because it's such a dominant language, a bit like it's probably half the population of Malawi. Two-thirds. But for the others, it still can function as an LWC, yeah. Right. No one speaks Mandarin in their own homes. Right, okay. I mean, okay, so you've got in the south of China, you've got these very different forms of... I mean, if you looked at them afresh, you'd say they were different languages. Yeah, but then Mandarin is often taking I think in the north, people do speak some form of Mandarin at home, but... Okay, and yes, so you've got... China would be a country with monolingual parts and multilingual parts. And you tend to get a similar dynamic even with standard and non-standard dialects. But we just don't call it multilingualism. Right, so they're the Luxembourgish would sort of be taking the vernacular slot. Yeah, that's actually... Right, but they probably wouldn't use it in the supermarket. Yeah, when they go outside. And this is where I'm trying to restrict you to within the community where you are. Yes, there's also languages for external use and so on. And English is often the main one, not in absolutely every country, but in almost most countries. Yeah? Right. Right. There is some parts of the country where people naturally use their mother tongue is Spanish, but a lot of the indigenous origin people speak Guarani. Okay. I mean, you do also get systems where different ethnicities are all mixing, and like in South Africa, will have different vernaculars, and then, well, but also that's the Kenyan, you know, Kenyan situation. People from different ethnicities live next to each other quite a lot. And I don't know the Paraguayan situation, but I understand that there are still valuations of, well, this is, now it's appropriate to speak Guarani, but in this context, it's a formal context, you should speak Spanish, and so on. Okay, so that's just a little attempt. There is another thing in the system, which we don't want to forget, which is the arising urban vernaculars, which different people will talk about different ways. But the things like, well, if you don't know the names, it won't help, but Sheng in Nairobi, Tsotsitaal in South Africa, which are mixed codes. There's a lot of mixing. I mean, say Sheng is based on Swahili. It's based on dramatically simplified Swahili, which is the Swahili that people actually speak in Nairobi. But it's got lots of English. You've got bits of Kikuyu, bits of Luo, lots of new words, and so on. But it's kind of taking a place in the town. You're saying, well, we're townies. We're Nairobians rather than... so you actually talk to people, and for some, being a Nairobian is a more significant identity marker than being Kikuyu or Luo. And these urban vernaculars are a symbol of being a Nairobian, or a particular type of Nairobian. And what type of... Well, he's not necessarily well-educated. He's, you know, but he belongs there. And what Sheng means to different people... The problem with the word Sheng... means different things to different people. I've done interviews on this, and people will define it very differently. But you have this urban code, which is in some ways taking the same role in the three-way system as the traditional vernaculars. But it's drawing, it's lots of hybridity going on, it's drawing on all the resources that people have. You could argue they're trying to show who they're linked to. They're linked to their roots, they're linked to the global market, they're linked to hip-hop, and stuff. You got to sing. Hip hop has to be in Sheng. You know, that's the way it has to be. Even if they sing about homies and stuff. So, we tend to have shared attitudes towards the varieties. So, towards the vernacular, there is going to be a bit of stereotyping going on here, but this is necessary to make generalizations. Vernacular kind of represents authenticity. You're a real. It's authentic. It's who you really are. And solidarity at the local level. Solidarity, I've got, is one of the basic words here, along with power. People, we're expressing relationships in the way we talk, and the way we choose languages, the way we pronounce certain words shows the kind of relationships we're trying to construct. So we've got, so often it's also a symbol of tradition and local beliefs, perhaps, negatively seen as a sign of backwardness, orality. LWC also has some levels of authenticity and expressing solidarity, but not at the local level, regional, national level. So if someone from your tribe speaks to you in Swahili in Kenya, it's like, what? And they know, like, why aren't you speaking? But a Kenyan speaking to a Kenyan using Swahili from different groups can be a way of sharing in a Kenyan identity in a way that English doesn't. In rural contexts, however, it may be used to symbolize power or influence. And for the official, language, often a symbol of modernity, progress, of international contexts, power is the big one, respect, formality. It's sometimes in theological terms, and this is one of the problems, seen as more precise. It does, however, lack authenticity. You do not show that you are a true African by speaking English or French or Portuguese and so on. So, for example, a typical scenario in a school, a secondary school in Kenya, the class is officially in English, but if you want to talk to the teacher about something to help you out or whatever, you'll talk in Swahili. But when you see the headmaster, you'll speak in English, because that's a much more formal context. And I don't think it's just Kenya that does that. A bit of vocabulary for you. Diglossia is a variably defined word, but we'll just use it this way. The phenomenon which is different languages, varieties with different functions and attitudes within the society. It literally means two tongues. So sometimes people talk about tri or polyglossia. Diglossia is fine. And the main keys, as I've said, to understanding the choice of variety are normally power and solidarity. So you need to see what messages are being sent by the choice of the variety, where there is a choice. Where there is no choice, of course, two Ugandans from different ethnicities who only share English, they don't have recourse to show. They're not showing a lack of solidarity by using English, if that's the only thing they can speak to each other, because that's the only thing they can do. But if they share Luganda or Swahili and just speak in English, it can be an example of something not being quite right. Something I could have shown you is an example of a conversation in Nairobi going wrong. Two people are talking Swahili. It's quite clear they don't trust each other. So one switches to English, and the other one switches also to English. I can play that game. So that's the kind of thing that goes on. People are sending messages, not just by the words they speak, but the language that they use in speaking them. So, what problems does this cause? You've got, well, you could also shout out some answers. You want to shout out some answers? What problems these multilingual systems can cause beyond the fact that monolingual people don't necessarily understand them? Okay, well, I'll give you my answer. Right. Get misunderstandings, yeah.
I have an Argentinian friend who married a Korean woman, and the only language they come was English. Mm-hmm. And he's telling her that they have to reach a compromise on something. Whereas what he really wanted to say that he really wanted them to be committed to something because he used a Spanish word in English.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. That's the general problem of people talking to each other from different language backgrounds. Yes, it causes problems. Well, we've got this. Now, if you look at what happens, and much of the prestigious church life in say, somewhere like Kenya, and administration of church life, and especially education, goes on in English, which is associated with power. Got 5 minutes left. Oh, goodness. I'm only halfway through my slides. there's also, well, so let's speed through these. So we've got a preference. Now, and this is very variable. You'll go to some Churches sometimes fossilize language use. So even sometimes where there's a powerful language and a less powerful language, church usage sometimes goes with the less powerful, even where that's not necessarily the best. So you've got parts of Wales where the church language was Welsh, the village has shifted to English, but the church is still meeting in Welsh. Where's the relevance there? So church situations sometimes fossilize what used to be. Tradition becomes important in church, as well as power and solidarity. But those two things are still there. So you get this preference for the official language, or sometimes LWC, in church and spiritual life. The official language might be seen as more authentic for a universal faith. You know, yes, what my grandparents believed is local and traditional, and we'll use our local language in that. But this is Christianity, the gospel's part of modernity and everything, so we better use the language that's appropriate to that. Again, people probably don't say it quite that way. And my students have often told me they don't know the words to preach in their vernacular, even if they speak it fluently. Now, of course, some of my students don't speak their vernacular very well at all, so no wonder they can't preach in it, fine. But some of them can speak it just fine, except about God, which concerns me. One of my more controversial things I used to say to my students is, if you speak your language well and you can't explain a theological concept to your congregation, then I say to you, you don't understand that concept. They didn't like that very much. Maybe they didn't know the word, fine. But if you understand something, you can explain it. But of course, explaining something in a sermon and not knowing the word doesn't make you look very good. There is then this problem of people, you know, so I've been in churches where the preacher's preaching in English, and it's a very poorly educated congregation. They don't know what's being said. It's very interesting. Why are they there? Maybe there's a translation into Swahili, but the translator, he's not seen the text before. He's just making it up as he goes along. And the relationship with increased syncretism, lack of connection with local realities and expressions of faith, I think, is a big issue. The increased syncretism is a little bit complicated, how that actually works out, but I think it is a factor. I'm going to have to hurry on, I'm afraid. So, a problem for mission? Restricting the gospel's application to... So if you're saying, no, we do everything in English, you're restricting the application just to formal domains and away from the language that was said yesterday that people argue in. And if you're not touching that part of life, you've got a big problem. Neither challenging nor building on beliefs held in the vernacular. There's just a sort of disconnect, which is also what often education in English is like. It can be a big disconnect. Throw away everything you already know. Here we're starting all over again, rather than building on what's already known. So Kwame Bediako, the now deceased Ghanaian theologian, became a Christian in France, in French, and then went back to Ghana and started reading the Bible in Twi, his own language, and he finds this language about angels and thrones, which for the Ashanti who speak Twi are central concepts in their beliefs. And it's like, oh, now I see Jesus is on the highest throne. He is above all the other sort of demigods, which his stuff in France hadn't addressed at all. It's like, oh, wow, I understand this so much better. This now relates to my culture. And so he was one of the proponents of using and theologizing, not just using, but theologizing in African languages. You get an increased dependence on external sources if you're just using the official language. And I think I've already made that point afterwards. So the answer is everything in the vernacular then, isn't it? Well, might be some problems there as well. But there could be, but where the vernacular is the first or dominant language, and this is one of the problems of talking about the mother tongue in Kenya. I talked about this with my students, and they think, oh, well, I'm a Kikuyu, so you want me to do all my ministry in Kikuyu in the town. Oh, that will cause fights. No, we're not saying that. But where it's spoken, where it's the dominant language, we really want to be using that, because if people aren't emotionally connecting to the gospel, then there's a big, big problem. So in many Kenyan towns, probably using, say, Swahili, Because sometimes people say, oh, we use English because people are from different tribes, so we can't use it. Well, why don't you use Swahili then? Often the not actual reason is presented. People don't know why they make these choices often, but they just make them. Often it's because they're following what's been done before. And I had asked my students, and they go, you know, I never thought why is preaching in English rather than in Swahili. And I've had students who then tried preaching in Swahili and so on. And someone said, you know, people paid attention. They didn't fall asleep. Hey, they understood it. That would be a surprise. But there is also a belief that, as I said, the vernacular is backward. If you look at the reactions of many Africans to introducing education in vernaculars or languages of wider communication, it's often very negative, because education is seen to be about getting English, even though actually teaching people in their own language first has been shown to ultimately help them get English, but not just English, a whole bunch of other stuff like being able to read, write, do maths much better. But that's against some level of common sense. But often there's a very strong reaction against it. In Uganda, I've seen a study where the parents believed it was because the government wanted to make their kids fail, because they don't like our ethnicity. That's why they're introducing education in our language. So we've got some very strong attitudes, which might be surprising, because there is the problem of people just not understanding what's going on. So, okay. We minister in multilingual societies, so the answer is, let's do that multilingually. Now, that creates some issues and problems. And in the vernacular. You know, when I worked in Tunisia, my Tunisian Arabic is pretty fluent, and that's what I talk with Tunisians. When someone wouldn't speak Arabic with me, when they speak to me in French, it was like, this isn't a real person I'm talking to. This is a projection of who they want me to see them to be. It's not that every conversation in French was not genuine, but there's been research done also in development. Clinton Robinson, who asked people in a Cameroonian village the same questions in French and in their vernacular, they gave very different answers. What should we do about wife beating? In French, oh, it is a terrible thing, you must not do this. In the vernacular, well, you know, it's not good, but they just need a bit of discipline, these wives. You get different answers in different languages. And which one is reflecting the true beliefs? I think in the vernacular. So if you're doing the gospel just in French in that context, you're not actually getting to what people really believe and what they think. And we need to listen to some of our friends in development. Messages that want to affect a change in behavior. I had the leader of African work of a major NGO saying, look, when we do it in English, it just doesn't work. When we do anti-AIDS messages, it doesn't work. It doesn't really work that well in Swahili. We have to do it into the vernaculars. He was frustrated because he had to do all this translation. So if it doesn't work, because that's something I can measure, behavior. Because behavior changed when they did these things. Not everybody, but you had a percentage change. And if that's the case of aid messages working better in vernaculars, I wonder if that might have a similar effect on the gospel as well. Now, however, we need to understand the problems with and the issues to face when we're using vernacular. There are these attitudes, often very negative attitudes, by the speakers of those languages to those languages. Very odd, very hard for us as monolinguals to understand. In covert, you know, so they're not, often people won't express them quite the way. Sometimes they do. They say, oh, Kikuyu won't get my children a good job, and so on. In some contexts, the vernacular might not communicate the expected respect. Now, I've seen one or two preachers do this. It used to really annoy me. They'd start their prayer, O Lord, thou that art in heaven. Why are they speaking this language? And then I would listen to them. I was, the linguist. They switched to you most in the prayer because they couldn't keep it up. But what they'd done was to mark to the congregation, we're addressing God, and we're doing it slightly differently. Now, I'm not saying we should therefore go around saying thou in our prayers, but that's what was going on. One or two speakers can do this. They'll start off a little bit of English, just to show, hey, you respect me, and then go into the vernacular, so people understand. But they've established who they are and their respect. So occasionally something like that might be a good little trick. To communicate that he's an important guy. And this is worth listening to. There's a lack of materials. That's an issue. Establishing appropriate terminology, which I have a slide on and I don't think we're going to get to. Preachers feeling, because they've been trained in English, they don't know how to say certain things in a vernacular LWC and don't want to look stupid. So they won't do it. That's also true, but I mean, you can always get the information in one language and then. People are also used to being educated and doing formal things in English, and so they're not necessarily doing it just because of power. It's often because that's just what you do. That's what feels the best. It's difficult to look at people's motivation. It's variable. People, if they haven't been well-educated in their mother tongue, we're looking at reading stuff here, they might have actual difficulty reading their own language. Tends to be, and this might sound like linguistic heresy to those who sometimes know some linguistics, that vernaculars are more complicated than LWCs or the European languages. They have more tenses, they have more vowels, they have more tones. LWCs tend to have been simplified by the fact they've been spoken by lots of second language speakers. I can wind up, so I'll just finish with this. So often people have a genuine difficulty in reading their own language. Swahili doesn't present problems particularly, but Kikuyu and so on definitely does. Often in a community, the first Bible translation, if done by a foreigner, it's not that easy to understand. And God bless the foreigners who did it. And often also these languages probably undergo language change more quickly than English does. So that's another factor. Words come in and go out more quickly. So you've got the Camber Bible, which uses, excuse me, but where it says water, that's the word that people say for semen these days. So people, if they don't not used to it, it's watches. There are problems like that. Or an unnatural Bible translation. And also often, there might be a sort of standard version, but people don't really agree or don't know what the standard variety of the language is. So they read this, it's like, oh, it's a different dialect and so on. So there are some genuine reading issues. This is not a counsel for despair. But it is just saying there's more difficulty to it. And my final comment, which I'll finish on, is as the outside worker, it's possible, hello Jim, you've done it, to learn these vernaculars. They are harder to learn for lots. It's not on the next slide. There was one point. Lack of a recognised standard or sentence of language. Learning vernacular is harder, generally. One, I've already said they're more complicated. There will not be language schools to teach you many of these languages. You may already speak the LWC, so you can talk to people. Not being able to speak to people is a great motivator for learning their language. But if you already can, you have to be very disciplined to learn their heart language. It might be more appropriate to try and learn the heart language before the trade language. It will seem very odd to the people you're ministering with. Because obviously you have prestige and power, so how come you're not speaking a language of prestige and power? It's possible. It's probably a better solution. But you're not going to find books, dictionaries, etc., etc., etc. You'll find people wanting to speak to you in other languages and maybe not used to explaining their language. So It's harder. That's, I think, one of the reasons why people give up. Harder for mainly social reasons, not because the languages are all so much harder. They are a bit harder, but that's not the main reason. But I think that's a challenge we need to take seriously. You know, I've talked with missionaries saying, well, I learnt the LWC. I was exhausted after that, so I just couldn't be bothered. But I think that's a serious problem, to be honest. Easy for me to say, I love learning languages. I didn't learn Swahili very well. I learnt Tunisian Arabic really well. I'm a partial success and a partial total failure. There you go. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, mate. There's obviously been a certain amount of reactions we've been going through. Just thinking about this Bible thing in Malawi, the Chichewa Bible, the new one came in, a little bit like the new Swahili Bible.
Right.
It became accepted by the young people.
I mean, that's another factor. We tend to the Bible that we became a Christian in or had early Christian growth in tends to become God's word to us, and in some ways that's a really good process. The fact that we accept it without constantly questioning, is this the right translation? Is that the right? Because if you do too much of that, it doesn't really help you. The problem with that is we get stuck, and these things become boundary markers. That the true Christians talk about, propitiation rather than expiation, and so on. Words which, to most people in England, mean nothing whatsoever. But there are equivalent things, and I hope I haven't offended anyone just by saying that. Or is it the other way around? I can't remember. So often there's a boundary marker. A true Christian, so in an Islamic context, Christians don't say Alhamdulillah, because that's what Muslims say. Even though it says means praise to God, we say thank God, and so on. Which is interesting, because say where I was working earlier, the Christians were perfectly happy to use that expression, because they weren't trying to mark themselves off from Muslims by language, apart from maybe avoiding one or two other phrases, but were more directly not quite right. So I think that's the kind of phenomenon going on there. This is the holy book, and we are the holders of the tradition. What are you lot doing using this other version, which we don't approve of and doesn't sound quite right to us, and we know who translated it? Okay, I'm not 100% sure I got your question, but I'll try and give an example and see. One of the interesting things my students have told me about, I've not been able to verify this myself, those Presbyterians, do we have any Presbyterians here? No? Well, you know, they all speak Kikuyu. And they embraced Kikuyu in the church. So much so, if you find a PC, I mean, Jim, I don't know, if you find a PCEA, Presbyterian Church of East Africa Church, even outside the Kikuyu homeland, there'll be Kikuyu services there. My students took this as extremely negative, because it's divisive, and that's another problem I haven't really talked about, that people often say, you can't use tribal languages in Kenya. Look, we've had violence. And it's some people's minds, using the vernacular language is almost within earshot of anyone else who could possibly even hear it, is a tribalist action, which I don't think it is. If you're deliberately excluding people, that's another matter. But there is this kind of, ooh, we mustn't do that because... And they... Oh, well, it's often more applied to other people. They were speaking Kikuyu, those Kikuyus. But, yeah, when a church does that, that's a thing. But it's a kind of Kikuyu, being Kikuyu... I mean, there are Catholic Kikuyus and other Kikuyus, but it's a big Presbyterian... You know you're going to have Kikuyus there in Kenya because of the way that different missions parceled up the country. Is that what you're asking about?
I didn't think what it
There was a paper about the Solomon Islands which said that you could tell kind of by the way that people spoke the same language whether they were charismatics or traditional Anglicans. It's kind of interesting. But I'm not aware of that having been noted anywhere else. Jim?
This notion of lack of being identified with tribalism, can you compare and contrast it with Western Europe?
And what particular context?
And total opposite approach.
Yeah, no, and those attitudes say in Kenya, and that's not the case everywhere in Africa. In South Africa, that's not the case. Sotos don't mind Zulu speaking Zulu. So in Kenya, the president, who is a Kikuyu, could not give a speech in Kikuyu. Local politicians, MPs, do it all the time. A local politician has to be able to speak the three. Campaigning locally, he has to do it in the vernacular to show, I'm one of you. The president, when he gives a talk, and this is a general pattern in Kenya, starts off in English, reads his script, puts his script down, starts speaking in non-standard Swahili. He's got to be presidential, but he wants to connect with the people. But he couldn't use Kikuyu because that would be tribalist. In South Africa, Zuma can talk in Zulu. It's not a problem. No one minds. It's African. Partially because there isn't one uniting LWC, African LWC. English is kind of taking that role in South Africa. English and some urban vernaculars. So it's a very, very different. Some of these attitudes are different in different places. I don't know if in Uganda, if the president could give a speech in Luganda or not. I haven't got a clue. But it's interesting to look at these things. What is acceptable? Because it shows the values that underlie the system. And what I've presented to you, this three-language system, there are places in West Africa where they use six. There are other countries where they mainly use two. You can almost be monolingual in parts of Ethiopia, except that secondary education is officially in English, which no one really speaks. So in practice, it's Amharic with English textbooks. But English is sort of there, but it's not even an official language. It's just a language of higher education. Other parts of Ethiopia, you've got minority languages, and then you've got English, and then you've got Amharic. Anyway, so you get some very different dynamics. Some of them are developing. South Sudan is a place where they haven't quite settled yet. It's a new country. Jim? Well, I think what I've tried to say is if we're missing out on the vernacular, we're missing out on something very big. Now, okay, I've expressed that in a very English way. It is a significant problem where the majority of ministry is carried out in other languages. And that failure of engagement, of the whole church. It's not just an issue of missionaries, but it's an issue even... One of the things I tried to do, I ended up having teaching not just people wanting to be Bible translators. Most of my students, when I talked about these issues, were guys who were wanting to be pastors, Bible school teachers, missionaries themselves. So I wanted them to think about language issues. And it was trying to push them towards being ready to use the vernacular. And some of my students did it. Actually, some of my brightest students were the ones that did it. And I'm not just saying they're unrighteous because they did it, but some of them actually stepped out and said, well, I've only ever preached in English before. I'm going to preach in Kikuyu. I'm going to go to the village, and I'm not going to take an interpreter. For me, that's important. What long-term has happened, I've no clue. But you can only do what you can do. But there you are. Is that prescriptive enough for you, Jim? It's edging in the direction. But on the other hand, to say, therefore, anything in another language but the vernacular should be abandoned is also, I wouldn't agree with that. Especially in urban contexts, and because people are multilingual and they're operating using three in the system I've described languages. In particular ways, those other languages also need some slots, need some places. But interesting, helping people to think through how do you deal with a multilingual congregation? Saying, well, I'd love, you know, well, you can sing songs in different languages in church. Might need to be very politically careful. So it was very interesting at chapel at Next, where I was teaching in Nairobi. We'd sometimes sing songs in Swahili, fine. The next languages we'd sing in would be Kinyarwanda or Lingala, not Kikuyu or Kamba or Luo, because, people would see them, it's the Kikuyus taking over. I said, look, just make sure you sing one in Kikamba and in Kikuyu and one in Luo, and you'll be fine. And apologize to the others and say, you'll do it next time. But that kind of thinking had never really, it was too scary. Kinyarwanda's not scary, that belongs to somewhere else. They could have probably sung in Luganda, wouldn't be a problem. It's the nice Ugandan singing their song. Okay. And you know there are ways of preaching to a bilingual congregation, which don't involve an interpreter. Some preachers I've seen doing this, say in a very middle class church in Nairobi, which is using English. I've seen one or two good preachers say the thing in English, and then make the point again in Swahili. They weren't saying the whole thing in Swahili, but it gets people. Or tell a story and I'll do a little bit of it in Swahili. And there are ways of doing a kind of... So even, you know, someone might not understand all the Swahili. Hey, I've still got the message. But the others are getting much more deeply. Okay. Yeah. But Maltese is what everyone speaks. Maltese is what everyone speaks at home. Yeah, there are some solutions. You sometimes will have a congregation where there's not one language that works for everybody. There are solutions. You can even, without headphones, you might be able to just say, well, there are some sensitivities. Okay, the Americans, can you all go in that corner? Thank you. We'll translate the soccer idioms into American football ones over there. Yeah, you've got to be sensitive, but with the sensitivities, there are sometimes ways of doing these things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can just have one person translating for one person. Another thing that will happen, if you're ministering in a multilingual situation, people say, oh, we would do it in the vernacular, but, you know, there's so-and-so that sometimes comes. And you know, to respect it, he's not our ethnicity, so we have to do it in English or Swahili. It's like, well, maybe you could just provide a translator for so-and-so, or still do the language and just have a little bit rather. And the question is then, those old grandmas, are they really understanding what you're doing? And I've had stories of where, you know, someone's, it's not just the grandmas, actually. A lot of people know enough to bluff, but not to understand well. They will not say, no, I don't understand, because that's shameful. But often sometimes excuses that people, again, from a study in Uganda that I heard, people saying, oh, no, we can't do it in Luganda because there are a couple of kids from other tribes who speak Luganda perfectly. So then the Ugandan presenting saying that's not the real reason, it's just a kind of rationalization. And often there is a lot of rationalization that people believe themselves. They actually believe it, I think, often. But we need to try and sometimes see behind what people are saying to understand. Yeah, no, a lot of people would prefer to read the Bible in English or French. And that, again, is going to look different in different places. In some places, like in Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, you have people who are monolingual French, essentially, who are Ivorians. I mean, they'll probably know a little bit of Djula, a little bit of what their parents or grandparents spoke, but French is the market language. One of the market languages is also Djula of Abidjan.
Came to faith at university in a French environment, and she could not communicate her faith in her own language because she had to learn the vocabulary.
Yeah, it can be learnt, but she couldn't get round to it. That's interesting, because it wasn't seen as that valuable. There are issues of prestige and all that sort of stuff coming in there. But you know, if someone does become a Christian, and it does happen in a language, it does happen quite a lot, I think also trying to, I mean, so say with immigrants in this country or there, trying to get them to look at stuff in their own original language as well, I think is actually very important. Doesn't mean they're not a Christian if they don't. But helping them to actually start to accepting, at least thinking about reading the Bible in Chinese as well as English. And also sometimes, I mean, I remember talking to a Japanese Christian who recorded music and stuff. I said, oh, do you do Japanese style music? He said, oh, no, Western style, because Christianity is a Western religion. Okay, right. Thank you.
Sorry we've been pushing you a little bit.
No, it's fine.
Great material. Yeah. It's helped us. I think it's given us a kind of scientific background to some of the thinking that we've perhaps already had, but needing to put it together.
I've also got a little bit of stuff on how to think through how to approach developing new terminology where it doesn't exist, which is sometimes necessary. Very brief and cursory. There you go. I'll shut up.
Will you be able to email these things to us?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, there's a bit on that. I've got another presentation I gave at Bible Translation Conference last month that is more on that. Maybe I'll make that available as well.
So, yeah, okay. That's great. Let's just have a word of prayer together, shall we, before we break. Father, we thank you for having our eyes open to some of the problems and some of the things which we've just wondered about in the past. Thank you that the important things that you communicate with us and with your people wherever they are. Show us what our job is in making that communication something which can be understood.
Thank you for being with us. Thank you for Mike's work. And we pray for your blessing on him and the work that he continues to do, both in Redcliffe and at Wycliffe. Lord, thank you for this time together. In Jesus' name. Amen. We have a break until supper, which is 6:30. And then after 6:30, we have... We have a session that Jean Johnson's going to speak. Is it Jean going to speak tonight?
Yes.
Yes, Jean's going to speak tonight. The intention originally was we were hoping that we'd have a number of folk from the church here come in for supper with us, and then to stay on for the evening session. We've got a few people coming to have supper with us and to stay on, but not enough for Jean to do as we had thought originally, to do a complete overview of Vulnerable Mission for people who didn't know what we were talking about, and to draw them into the web, as it were. So Jean's got something else which will cover part of that, and something to do, I think, to do with change. In
so people, folks should come at 7:30,
and
then Jean will be at 7:30.
Yeah.
So between now and 7:30
is supper. Supper's in 20 minutes. But that gives you a chance to get hold of Mike and have further chat and keep going the discussions. There's very few people who aren't in discussions all of the break time, so that's great. And that does mean we're beginning to relate well together. Fine, thank you. Thanks, Mike.
Do you ever think of doing something like an amplified kind of, you know, where you put two or three words that all look pretty good and gradually wait and see what people think best or what works best?
Yeah, it's very difficult to read, especially for someone who's not used to reading very much. So trying to make things reasonable. So even things like footnotes, which we like, for some people that don't read very much, footnotes make the whole thing look very difficult.
I find it really happens. It's really, really, really personal.
Yeah, I love him, but you know, I know I'm not normal. You know, and I think one of the ways forward is releasing audio recordings of stuff, which, and seeing how well it works. You know, I mean, we're meant to do that kind of stuff, but actually, releasing audio scripture now people have. You don't even need a smartphone to listen to. A lot of these very basic phones actually have sound cards. Yeah. One was, I mean, that you can, a little bit of storage,
think doing that and then doing a quick and dirty one first time around and then going, okay, getting it used. Yeah.
It's been interesting watching the Holman translation. I don't know if you've been interested to look at it at all,
I've
bought a copy of the Holman translation, the English translation of the Bible, 5 years ago, and I think
Holman translation.
Yes, it's a Holman standard.
It says it's the most accurate.
It's the same. It's like the same train as the ESV, but it's a bit more American. It's very, very readable. But over the last 5 years, there's been so many new editions that my one I bought 5 years ago. So our church has just decided to use it as the church Bible, and I just like what I've downloaded onto this is quite a different one than what I've got in paper that I've bought. So they have been updating it. This one, really wish they'd updated it. Didn't turn out this week. It's too big. It's got a few funny quirks in it.
Yeah.
It's extremely readable.
All translations have quirks.
Yeah, in Cambodia, they had the original Bible translation that was used for a couple of decades. It's really not that good. Put together a really good committee to really update, go over the whole thing. Up with a much better translation. Church just hates it.
Well, this is the problem with the ESV. It's a really good translation. But that's another question for just general translation. Depending, of course, on how much a society is divided demographically, both in different parts and types and age groups as well. But, you know, once you get to particularly westernised culture, what the youth speak of is quite different to what adults speak.
Yeah, and in these less standardised languages, it's more fluid. You know, in English, we kind of know what the standard is.
But it's less standardised than Spanish.
And, you know, there's a little bit of tolerance. The more formal it is, the more... So, I mean, academic writing, apart from spelling... Very hard to tell in American from a Brit.
Right.
If you're reading tabloid press, you can see it very quickly. But so even that, those things, what is the standard of an actual language? Maybe there is, someone's got one, but unless the community actually recognises that, not that everyone uses it, but recognises, oh yes, that's, then it's not really functionally a standard language.
And as a missionary, you have to be very clever to speak the right vernacular with each demographic too.
Oh yeah, I mean
we learned our language and spoke and worked with university students, and every now and then, you know, I'd just be talking with a bunch of adults my own age and realise that I'd said something I really should have said.
My son-in-law grew up in Indonesia, Kalimantan, and as a child he spoke Indonesian.
Right.
And then he went through English schooling, finished up his education in this country, and was then called back to work in Indonesia. And so we said, it's five of you already speaking English. He says, what I learned was childhood in Indonesia. And I hadn't read any of the biblical vocabulary. I'd never read it. He said, I had to start from scratch. I mean, obviously, it was an advantage of, you know, what he learned. But he said it was hard work. He was talking about years or so, hard work to actually get into.
Right. You probably have some of the grammar.
But he learned, he not learned it as grammar.
Yeah, well, all better.
By talking as yes. Yeah. But now he's very fluent.
We have a difficulty of serving in many Spanish speaking countries that all speak Spanish. And we speak very strong Argentinian Spanish. And so, you know, it's, in Spain, you can just remember the list and you get away with it. You know, it's not too bad because nobody talks in the formal language anyway, which Argentinians don't use. But you go across an altitude
I guess that's particularly in Chile. It's probably more in Chile than anywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, because we're Christian and they love us and all that. Right.
So is Luis Palau less popular in Chile than elsewhere in Latin America? Because he was very popular in Peru. No one minded him.
Yeah. Oh, I really don't know. As soon as I get there, I start changing my tone because women speak a lot higher pitch and much more sinfonia than Argentinians. Argentinians, especially from Buenos Aires, they speak Italian and Spanish good. We didn't realise that. The whole Buenos Aires culture is like aggressive in your face and they talk like that. And everybody from the provinces, which is where we live, just kind of don't like them because they're aggressive and horrible. We didn't understand this until we started as a missionary. We go, talk what they talk in Buenos Aires, except they're using Italian words, you know. Because the biggest racial influence in Buenos Aires is Italian.
That's
right. The language.
Yeah.
It's quite funny.
Yeah, and there are more Italian people from Italy than Spain.
Yeah. And particularly VA, sort of like 38% of VA has Italian groups.
Right.
And so that really affects, because Italians are kind of aggressive, really fast people, by and large. I found
38%, that's quite interesting. I suppose you can tell from the Zoom.
Oh, yeah. they've all got their nonna and their nonna. Mm. Yeah, and they're quite Italian.
Interesting.
It's quite fun to now go to other parts of the world. Find where things originate.
Interesting you're talking about Malta, actually. A place I've been a few times.
Yes, he does, because he's North African.
Yeah, that's where that's my connection.
Yes, that's what he does in the church. Yes, his story is fascinating, because why he's done Malta.
Mm-hmm.
So he was first converted, I think, through a missionary passing through.
Okay.
And only have one in his family. And he thought...
The Maltese Baptist scene isn't very good.
However, when he was first converted, he thought there were only six Christians in Malta.
Right.
Because he's only seven. Or something. Mm-hmm. He said, I've got daughters. There was nobody for my children to marry who were Christian. And so they actually applied to be immigrated to Australia. I feel like he was in the...
25% UK and the 25% Canada.
The second biggest Maltese population in the world. But his wife became ill just as they were about to go. He had a visa and everything. And so they stayed there. Dulot's man fought. And he went down to have a look. And he said, I discovered that there was actually 12 Christians in Malta.
And
it was. But, he ended up